Always.
I suggest that we all play a part in the introduction of Senator Warner. Today is Senator Warner's birthday.
There's mixed feelings. Someone. General Harry Distant. What?
Harry? What was that quote you gave me about turning 62? He gave it to me
last night. Pretty good. You know,
yeah, he has his compensations. I like that. That's right. The general started me in politics
20 years ago and then left me.
This, as all of you know, is to be a very informal colloquy. All of you know the senior senator's background, graduate of William and Mary.
William Washington and Lee. My father graduated Washington Lee and Autry was just rolled in his grave.
I knew I should have read from the notes, but I picked up the notes as we were going in, and it says gallon liquid bleats. We've been looking forward to this discussion for a long time on a good many subjects. Senator Warner has kindly consented to deal with your questions. He will have a brief opening statement, but then we hope it can be, as he put it, a Senate colloquy, in its form at least. So it's a great pleasure to have you with us, Senator.
Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out on this day. And I got up early this morning around 5:15 and decided since the snow had not come, you might appear. And indeed, here you are. Thank you for that rousing introduction. It reminds me of one I received about 2-3 weeks ago. A gentleman got up and he went on and on and on and covered every single item in the congressional directory, which outlines this humble background. And at the conclusion, he said, "There stands a model United States Senator." And you know I like that. And I got up and I gave my tub thumper of a speech, and they gave me one of the most prolonged standing ovations I've had in some time. I mention that because my daughter, who's now 29, was with me, and she was fixing my dinner that evening after this event, and said, "Father, I'm troubled by that introduction and that model bit." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, look here in Webster's Dictionary, the definition of model is a drastically reduced version of the real thing." You got about what you paid for. In 20 plus years of public service, I have always, and particularly now that I'm in my 11th year, privileged to be your senator, I've always followed the policy that it's better to listen than talk. I've never learned a thing by listening to myself speak. And that's why I'm anxious this morning to share a few thoughts and then perhaps receive your thoughts, criticism, ideas, or the like. And I say that most sincerely. One of the severe handicaps of the Senate is that you represent a whole state, approaching 6 million people. The breadth, the width, the length is such that I can only travel just so much, and at the same time try and maintain one of the highest records of attendance in the Senate. I, 4 or 5 years in a row, did not miss a single vote. But that precludes you from going back as often as one would like to visit with your constituents and others to get their advice and then, at times of election, their consent. And that's the subject I'd like to pick this morning. That short, phrase between two commas in the Constitution, which it says that the president shall nominate, comma, by and with the advice and consent, comma, and nominate such officers, cabinet, military, and others. And next week, on behalf of Virginia, and I say also on behalf of the United States, because a senator, the title is United States Senator. We feel, properly so, possessed by our state, but we do represent the 50 states collectively. But I, along with my colleagues, will cast votes on cabinet nominations. One in particular, which you've read about, the Secretary of Defense. And I would discuss today only the procedural aspects of that, because I think it's a matter of which I'm trustee as co-manager with none of the procedures, and therefore I would not want to get into a comment on the factual situation. I would, however, like very much to receive any factual or opinions that you have on the nomination. In other words, I can receive, but I can't reply in terms of giving you my thoughts on it. But I shall also make a second decision next week, equally important. And that is, under the traditions of the Senate, it's not written into law, but it's an inviolate tradition. The United States Senator of a state, of a president's party, has the sole right to recommend to the president individuals to become United States District Court judges. It goes way back into the sinews of our history. And a president cannot select another individual in that state and appoint him a district judge without the advice and consent of that senator. I don't care who it is. The House of Representatives does not have corollary powers under the advice and consent, only the Senate, and particularly with the federal judiciary. The President, of course, receives recommendations, and I, as a matter of courtesy to the members of Congress, do consult them. And there are two vacancies, one in the Eastern District of Virginia, and the second in the Western District. Now, I follow a procedure which is not unique, but not a great many senators follow that procedure. And that is that I travel to see these individuals whom I regard as eligible in their own environment, in their own neighborhood, such that I can talk with their colleagues and peers in the legal profession, talk with the bar associations, civic groups, and the like, to get their appraisal of the respective individuals that seek this position. I have finished my work in the Eastern District, and I've almost finished my work in the Western District. To give you an example, I traveled from Lee County, Virginia, to Winchester, from Winchester to Charlottesville. That's basically the Western District, Judicial District of this state. I've interviewed 14 individuals, and one of those will become the next district judge in the Western District. And I've done a comparable analysis in the Eastern District. And that individual will really sit, as you well know, in judgment of your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and all too often your property thrown in for good measure. So it's important that we find only the best qualified persons. Some senators don't want to do that. And I don't say that by way of criticism. They simply constitute a panel of jurists, leading lawyers in the state, and say, you decide, send me a couple of names, and I'll forward them to the president. There's certain advantages. One, you don't have to do a lot of travel. And two, the procedure of picking a federal judge has never brought any claim to a senator, because it only one individual who gets appointed, and the others go away disappointed, and any number of factions and bar associations will sit back and say, well, if you just listen to us, you made a better selection. So, that's under the judicial branch. And therein, I think one of the reasons that this tradition has grown up is that the judicial branch, being the third branch of our government, is totally independent of the president and the legislature. As such, a senator should have the right to nominate. Correspondingly, cabinet officers, ambassadors, senior officers in the military, are a part of the executive branch and are a part of the president's team. When the people of this great nation of ours sit down and cast their ballots and elect that individual president, then commensurate with that direction and mandate from the people is the right to give him the choice to pick whomever he wishes to implement his policy. Now stop, think about that. What is the extent of the Senate as it exercises advice and consent on that nominee? The president says, I want this individual, and don't you try and second guess me. You may not like his looks, you may not like his policy, you may not like some of the things he's done in the past, but that makes no difference. I was elected by the people, not you. Give him to me, or give her to me. And that's a pretty tough mandate. And consequently, only 11 times in the history, the 200 years history of this country, has the Senate of the United States rejected the president's choice for a cabinet position. And if you break that 11 down, there are 2 or 3 instances where the president sent the same name up 3 times and the Senate rejected it. So you can parse that out, and 3 and 3, 6, you're down to about 7 or 8 in history. Reminds you of the hundreds of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but thousands upon thousands of individuals that have held cabinet positions and sub-cabinet positions. Only 11 of the top cabinet officers have ever been turned down. 25 of the Supreme Court have been turned down. So the record is pretty good, and the Senate has been accused of rubber stamping. It's been accused of a lot of things, including just surrendering its authority to the president, not carrying out the mandate of the founding fathers. And next week in the Senate is likely to unfold one of the most historic debates on a cabinet officer that we've ever witnessed in our 200 years, for reasons which I expect most of you have gained through the press, which have covered this nomination. I hesitate to say fully or fairly, but anyway, it's been covered. So be it. So I would like to, Mr. Moderator, open up the floor for any discussion which might flow, and not necessarily confined to the advice and consent. I just bring that up because those are immediate decisions that I have to make within the next 10 days. And I thought perhaps you'd like to participate in that decision making.
May I ask the first question?
But before you do, it's a Saturday morning. And you know, these wonderful people have taken their time to come here. And I often say, if you can go away with one little story that you can use for your very own at a similar gathering, that was worth your while to come. So let me tell you a little story, which I like to mention at the time we go into a colloquy. I thought of it last night. I've been privileged. I visited with my friend, General Diston. I ran away from home in 1944 and joined the Navy. And then I served in the Marines in Korea, and then I was Secretary of the Navy for 5 years during Vietnam. So I have a great affinity with the Armed Forces of the United States. And this is the story of the old veteran who was going to attend his annual American Legion stag party. And that was a big event in this little community. And his wife knew that as a consequence of his desire to go, she had a certain amount of leverage, which resulted in about 10 items he had to fulfill before he got the permission to go. You know, cut the lawn, paint the house.
Yell the bleach.
And this particular individual, he fulfilled every one of those obligations. And he went upstairs on the night, put on his old tunic, his medals, his old cap, strode down the street. Well, as the custom, that party went on to the point where he was coming home at about 5:30 in the morning. The sun was just coming up, and he was sort of weaving down the street, reminiscing about all his comrades. And he got to the front door, he took out his key, and he hit it like this, and he couldn't even focus on the keyboard. He was so taken by the vapors. And all of a sudden, the door flew open, there was his wife, and he knew he had a little bit of a problem. He took two steps, and he fell right down at her feet. And she pointed down at him, and she said, "I want a complete statement out of you with respect to everything you did all night long with the boys at the Legion Hall." And he looked back up and he said, "My darling, sweet wife, I don't have a prepared statement, but I'll take your questions from the floor."
As you know, the talk show has been started in on this question of delay in appointments. As you also know, the Miller Center had a commission on presidential transitions, and Chase Untermyer spent a day here last August going over every point in the report. That commission, on which three former secretaries of state and three former secretaries of defense serve, recommended that if at all possible, cabinet members should be appointed in 4 weeks, sub-cabinet in 10 weeks. And now the media is going after President Bush and the administration for the slow process. Simply on the side of procedure, why the delay?
Well, in 1968, I had worked for President Nixon for many years. And I worked in the transition office. As a matter of fact, three of us were pretty much in charge of the transition in 68. And I had the responsibility for the Departments of State and Defense. So I have some background and knowledge, and today I'm working with Chase Untermyer and others on this transition. Let me entitle these remarks. I don't know if I can get the quote exactly, but one cabinet officer just a week or so ago told me, one old experienced hand in transitions told me, he said, how's it go? Yes, he said, "A hostile transition is far easier than a friendly transition." In other words, Lord forbid, if the Democrats had won, it would be a very simple matter. But since this is a friendly transition, and one which is almost unprecedented in modern times, because it's been so many years since a vice president succeeded the president, it is tough. And further, I think I have forwarded to the president no less than, I'm talking about serious nominations, 75 to 80 recommendations for cabinet, sub-cabinet, and ambassadorial rank and other appointments. Other members of the Senate and indeed the House have likewise sent in. The paper is stacked to the ceiling. All right, take my nominations. I feel strongly about several of them. I've gone to see Untermyer 3 or 4 times, as late as this week, on one. As a matter of fact, it was the day that he and the president met, and coming out of that was a rather a critical story in the Washington paper. I don't know if it's down here. But I want Untermyer to take care of my nominations. I'm not saying I've got to have them or I'm going to have any recrimination against the president, but I want to make certain they're considered fairly, which includes an interview at a bare minimum of these individuals. Every other senator feels equally strongly. And to, rather than offend the Senate, rather than offend the leaders of your party, and a lot of people who made possible your election to the presidency, you've got to go through this process rather slowly. Now, the president has named his cabinet. The confirmation procedure for the cabinet is nearly completed. The sub-cabinet, yes, we're far behind on that, and it's a handicap. There is no clear answer to your question, except that little quip that the friendly transition is more difficult than a hospital.
Next question.
George Allen, would you like to ask the gentleman over there?
Okay. Yeah. Don has a question.
Well, okay. George, go ahead.
No.
Well, Senator, obviously the question of the Tower nomination is kind of special, and I was wondering, would this have happened if he were being nominated for any other cabinet post, other perhaps than Secretary of State? Isn't the fact that he's in the chain of command?
Staff, yeah. Go ahead.
But if Tower had been nominated for Secretary of State, would it have applied as much? Since he is in the chain of command, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make it kind of special?
I'm afraid I'll have to decline to answer that question, because the answer would indirectly indicate my analysis of some of the factual material. I say that because I feel very strongly that far more important than John Tower, a man whom I've known exactly 20 years ago this month when I became Undersecretary of the Navy, I went up to call on him. He was then a senator. I served with him in the Senate, and when he was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, I was one of the juniors, and coincidentally, I'm now in his seat as a senior Republican. So much for that. And I feel very strongly that more importantly than John Tower is the public perception and understanding that the Senate went about this responsibility, as difficult it is, in accordance with the guidelines, although few, given by the Founding Fathers, and that this process is done fairly, equitably, and expeditiously. That question that you raise has been mentioned by several senators as a basis for their concern. The thought being, he's one of us, there is a certain amount of cronyism, and the old club is still there. Had it been Secretary of HEW, I don't know, I can't answer the question, but I think the question answers itself. There is concern. There is grave concern about a lot of facts, but I'm keeping an open mind until all those facts are in. Senator Nunn and I anticipate in the next 48 hours to receive a communication from the President that the executive branch, using the FBI, have completed their investigation. This will represent the seventh chapter. There have been seven separate chapters. Senator Nunn and I entered at chapter 4. And we went back and forth to the White House and asked that chapters 5, 6, and 7 be prepared. And this is the seventh. And I feel that that has given the executive branch and citizens in our country more than adequate opportunity to come forward, express their praise or dislike or whatever. And if they have opinions, so be it. Express those opinions. But if they have actual facts which can be corroborated or have probative value, then put those facts with the executive branch or the Senate, and they will be taken into consideration as the Senate reviews this nomination. Going back over the advice and consent clause, the Supreme Court has never touched it. It's interesting. Never tried to interpret that phrase and delineate the scope of that authority. And I think probably for good reason. It is the sole province of the Senate. You can go all the way from the theory that we, the Senate, should try and exercise a judgment to see that only the most qualified of people, as we do in the judicial branch, only the most qualified shall be given cabinet responsibility. And on the other extreme is really what the President said, I don't care what you think, I want him or her, give him to me, which means that unless you find some real substantial problem, you must give the advice and consent. Now, with the Secretary of Defense and the unique responsibilities that he has, unlike any other cabinet officer, that pendulum has probably swung into a more centrist position. But again, there are two steps in this thing. One is proposing with the Senate all the facts that the President has. And second, the duty of the Senate not only to review those facts, but to go through a deliberative process among ourselves. First in the committee structure of 20 senators, and secondly, the Senate as a whole of 100. That is where we receive the fairness and the equity. And the criticism I have of this process today is that some of my colleagues have seized on this piece of evidence, or that piece of evidence, or that quick reaction, and shot out and given their opinions, denying him the fairness and equity that he's entitled to of all the facts being considered simultaneously and the deliberative process preceding the vote.
Next question.
Yes.
Regardless of the specific facts involved, I mean, how many times he's been drunk, how many women he seduced, what countries they came from, how much money he got from this and that contractor to get certain weapons across and things, it would seem to me that it would be, I would wonder on what basis, after all of this, even if a lot of it may be a little irrelevant, maybe he didn't drink quite as much as they've alleged, or didn't have quite as many women from some of the same places, but to rationalize why this kind of person, when if you're really concerned about national defense, and Bush says he is, and if you're really concerned of getting a good appearance of ethics in government, getting rid of the sleaze factor that we all felt left with Mies, I would wonder how you'd rationalize saying, oh yeah, Tower would be a great secretary. There must be some basis for rationalizing.
I'm not able to answer that question. As I said, the ground rules, if I were to try and deal with it, it might leak out some of my innermost things, feelings about this nomination prior to my receiving all the evidence and also the benefit of the deliberative process. But I take your statement, which is one that is made in serious reflection by many individuals, to heart, because the President presumably went through that analysis before he sent the name to the Senate. And someday his reasoning may be made more fully public. I don't know.
There's a question behind it.
Senator, the delay of a prospective appointee of this magnitude is a little bit embarrassing to everyone, to the President, to the electorate. Is there some flaw or some procedural inadequacy in the investigative process that could allow the record of a nominee to be fully laid before the Senate for its consideration a little more promptly? It just seems to me, and perhaps to others, that this process has been strung out inordinately, that the full record on the individual in question has not been complete, and it keeps being added to and amended. Is there some way to improve that and avoid the kind of delay that we've had on this particular individual?
That's a pertinent question. And first I'd like to ask, inform you as to what actually takes place. Number one, this is not a criminal process or a criminal trial where you bring people in, put them under oath, where you go out and you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The traditional FBI background examination is conducted as follows, and I expect many of you in this room have either had it performed on yourselves or participated in it. An agent comes out and simply says, do you know Mr. or Mrs. X? I do. How long? And you state it. What are your feelings about them? Do you think they're trustworthy? There's a response. Do you feel that there's any risk in their handling, say, secret material? You give your response. The agent never tries to cross-examine you to get down and determine whether or not you're just prejudiced and it's leaking out, or in fact you really have some strong first-hand impressions or relationships on which you predicate your views. The agent simply copies down all the responses, puts it all together, and ships it to the Senate. And we sit there almost like a jury, and we have to sift through this information. Now, there are two procedural stop-starts in this case. Well, there are really three. The first is when the nomination came to the Hill, to our committee. Senator Nunn and I then were given the report, and we read it over and went through all of these statements, and it was one of the most thorough reports, if not the most thorough, ever put together by the FBI. But candidly, we felt that there were other areas that should be probed, and we specifically gave guidance to the president through his counsel, who in turn delegated the FBI to go back out and make a further examination. Now, mind you, the FBI works for the executive branch, an integral part of it, and it does not work for the Senate, so we work through the president's counsel to get the responses we feel were necessary. That was the fourth, I would call it. The four chapters went to the president. We asked for a fifth to be performed. It was performed in due course and sent back. And I looked it over, and at that time I felt probably the committee could go forward. And I consulted with my leadership, and Senator Nunn was a little reluctant, but I went out and said, I think this thing is postured now that we should meet. And that took place on a Tuesday about 10 days ago. That afternoon, Senator Nunn and I were invited down to visit with the president in his office. Just the president, John Sununu, president's counsel, and Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor. We went over the whole case, and it was concluded at that meeting that if the president would finish one or two additional details which we had requested, we would try and meet the following Wednesday and go to the deliberation process and determine whether or not we wanted to send the nomination to the floor. I was in my office, 7 o'clock at night. Counsel had, in the presence of the president, said, that material will be in your hands by close of business. Nunn was in his office. And we both got a call from the White House counsel that the FBI had stumbled onto something else in completing our request, which required more time. So the Senate was about to go out on the following Thursday for this recess period, which we're on now, and the whole process came to a halt, back out again. Senator Nunn and I worked, let's see, this is Saturday, yesterday together, and indicated to the White House we're ready to go at it again on Monday and Tuesday, even though it's a holiday period. So one stop was asked by the two senators who felt we should go out. The second stop was initiated by the president himself through his own counsel, who found a void in it and went back out and got additional material, which would be supplied to us on Monday. It's so important, this nomination, being in the chain of command. This individual is responsible for not only the national security of our national defense and our nation and that of our allies, but looking at it in a very prosaic way, he's responsible for the health, the welfare, and the safety of 2 million young men and women in uniform, a very large percentage of whom are far beyond the shores of the United States and the foreign lands on a perimeter of defense which is protecting our nation and that of our allies. And that's an unusual responsibility. He also has under his jurisdiction the allocation of $300 billion. That's quite a piece of cash. So I hope that after this is over, it's a perception that while it was prolonged, stopped, delayed, whatever the result may be, the process worked as it should with this particular nomination. Long answer to a good question.
Next question. Okay. Any questions in the outer office? Yes. Will you stand up, please?
That gentleman obviously has some background on this subject.
Retired Air Force General.
Yeah, he's retired Air Force General. The roles and mission, and having served in the Department of Defense for 5 years, 4 months, and 3 days, is the most sensitive of all. Now, it takes a few moments to deal with that issue. First, it was the vision of the Founding Fathers, and if you go back and look at the good old Constitution, which I read continuously, it states in there that the United States shall raise an army, the President shall raise an army, key word, raise an army, but he will maintain a Navy. Now, you can debate as to why those two words were selected, but I argue, as an old sailor, that maintain means you'll keep in place a Navy because this is essentially an island nation. And we're dependent economically on the sea lanes of the world. We're dependent for our security on the sea lanes of the world. And it takes today at least 10 years from the first pencil to paper designing a ship before that ship becomes operational with the fleet. We have seen in past wars, in past times of conflict, that a young man or a young woman can be taken into the army and trained in a relatively short period of time, and that individual becomes a good fighter. Today it's less and less so because of the high tech involved. When I went into the Navy in 1944, and I look in the faces around here of many seniors, but you'll recall in World War II, about 25% of the men and women coming in, mostly men, couldn't read or write. I remember it well. My first night in recruit training, the old pot-bellied chief stood up and says, "All you guys who can read and write, raise your hands." I was scared to death. I rose in my hand, you know. And he said, "All who can't do it, raise their hands." And about 25% of them did. He said, "You smart so-and-sos who can, help those who can't fill out their forms." And that was my first experience in the military. All right, I point that out because the Army carefully looks after its own mission and its role, which is important. The Navy tenaciously hangs on to the concept of the sea lanes of the world as integral to our defense and our economy. Along comes the Air Force, used to be known as the Air Corps, and it was newly created out of the Army Signal Corps in World War I and became a unit of its own, I think, in 1947 is when we created. All right, that has certain roles and missions. Now, the gentleman is correct. As efficient as we've tried to maintain these three separate branches, and I tell you that in my opinion, it's necessary to continue three separate branches because the competition between them makes for a higher morale, it makes for tougher and better training. Canada tried to merge them all together and did so, and they're now beginning to unravel it and put them back together again as three separate entities. But there are a good deal of redundancies. I'll give you one, for example, helicopters. Each of those three forces has its own helicopter force. And when I was secretary, I tried to get through one decision, and that is, let us have a common helicopter training base. I mean, the same basic machines are used by the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Why can't we have one command to train helicopter pilots and then let them scatter to the three entities? Oh no. The Admiralty took my head off because the Air Force, they don't fly at sea. And they took me out in a helicopter and darn near sunk me and showed me what it was to go into a stormy situation and try and land one of those things on the fantail of a pitching destroyer. And by the time we bounced down in fog and everything else, I was convinced that there was something to what they said and I forgot the decision. But we come up again time and time against that problem. Because if we were able to have common helicopter training, if we were able to have, should we say, uniformity in certain things like communications, I'm appalled by the different use of communications. I mean simple handheld radios right on up to the more complex one. each of the service feel they have to design through their research and development divisions their own, because it's integral to the Army. I tried one time, because I've been in radio and communications is my specialty in the military, to get the Marine Corps, now mind you, the Marine Corps and the Army to use the same basic equipment at platoon level. And I fought the decision hard. And again, I was practically taken out and hung because, no, the Marines, listen, we have to come in from a ship to go ashore, and ours might get wet underwater coming in, and we need a special one. And the Army said, oh, no, we are in the trenches of the mud, and ours could get wet, but we won't be in salt water, we'll be in fresh water. Now, I'm telling you, what went on, you see. So, I respond to you, efforts have been made, I bear the scars, but with the restricted budgets that are projected, and the president has indicated he's not going to give additional funds over and above the level funding ratio, and the chances are Congress will cut that back further, the military is going to be forced to reduce some of this redundancy among the three branches. Yes, sir.
Next question, George Allen.
First, Senator Warren, thank you in your office for your help on the omnibus drug bill last year, for that provision for Virginia. Do you see in this mix that we have now as far as our armed forces a more and more reliance on National Guard and reserves rather than full-time active? I know that there's been that trend. Do you see that trend continuing towards more of a...
Yes, and we have to do it again to conserve dollars. But it can only be done in certain areas. For example, the Air Force now, a substantial number of the MAC, that's Military Air Command, which is the transport plane, a substantial number of those missions are flown by reserve pilots. Because, A, they're superb pilots. Many of them are flying for commercial airlines, take off their weekends or their weeks or whatever they can and fly for MAC. And that program has worked superbly. Again, with the Army, you can integrate from the National Guard to the Standing Army very quickly. The problem, however, comes with the Navy. A ship has to deploy when it goes beyond what we call CONUS, so to speak, for about 6 months to make it efficient. Because it takes a lot of money to drive it all the way over to the Persian Gulf and to bring it all the way back. So when you go aboard a ship, you want a crew that has to stick with it 6 months. And there it's more difficult to bring in the reserves who cannot get a release from their civilian occupations for such protracted period as required to make deployment with ships. So where we can do it, we are using it. But to touch on another point, one of the debates in that drug bill was the extent to which we can utilize the military in fighting this war on drugs. And we all admit that war on drugs is far more serious in many respects than any military threat posed by the Soviet Union or another potential adversary. So we should be, as a nation, marshaling all of our assets to fight it. And there was a rush in Congress, particularly in the Senate, because we originated the bill over there, to have the military get fully into all aspects of fighting drugs. And I had to draw the line on one area, and I fought it, and together with Senator Nunn, we won. And that is, I'm opposed to giving to military personnel the right of arrest. Now stop and think about it.
That's right.
Way back in the formation of our country, and I'm now reading my 20th novel about the cavalry in the Wild West. Every time I want to daydream, I'd like to go back and to have been a cavalry officer back in 1870. Having come out of the War of the States as a decorated Confederate general, you know, and then go on. But anyway, we have passed an act called Posse Comitatus, which is still on the law book, because we experienced too much difficulty in the early formation of our state and the military at that time who did have the power of arrest, going out and arresting American citizens, their own citizens. And we, 117 years ago, I think it is, we took it off the books. We stopped it. And I think we ought to continue to prevent our military from doing it, because I don't want our young people getting involved in the arrests. So everything up short of arrest that we can do without denigrating our military readiness, we ought to be employed in the drug business.
Next,
yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Bush has said he wants a kinder, gentler nation. How can we do that unless handguns and semi-automatic guns are taken off the streets, especially in Washington?
Did everybody hear that question? The question is a tough one. It's gun control. Those of us that are a little barnacled in this business and been around for a long time, when he keeps saying a kinder and gentler, we're not entirely sure what he means, but let him work on. He's a good man, and I'm devoted to him personally and professionally. I say that because I've known him for almost 25 years as a personal friend. He's visited my home many times, and I've been privileged to visit his so much. I know the man, and he means what he says. And that of his lovely wife, I challenge you to give her the opportunity to prove she's going to be one of the greatest first ladies we've ever had. She's just a gem. So much for that. He made a decision the other day, you know, when confronted on these AKs, he backed off of it. It goes back to that constitutional provision again of every right of a citizen to bear arms. And where that line is drawn, it's tough to say. And he feels that there are some AKs that can be utilized for hunting. Well, I don't have much time to hunt anymore. I used to, but shotguns were sufficient and the .22 was adequate. But there's a very, very powerful lobby in this country which has decapitated more than one politician in its day. And they stay on readiness all the time. There's a slogan. Their idea of gun control is... looking down the barrel, not missing, or something like that. What is it? Jokes. It's serious. But I point out also, I have to spend all too much time in the District of Columbia. Essentially, you have to keep a place up there so you can go back to and from the Congress and all hours, and I've got a small apartment up there. They've had a tough gun control law for years. I mean, you cannot buy and own a handgun in the District of Columbia. And it's been that way for about 7 or 8 years now. Yet it is experiencing, you know, mortality rate crime higher than almost any other area in the United States. So gun control laws per se just don't work. It has been proven time and time again they just don't work very well.
But that's because, the District of Columbia is surrounded by states that do not have control.
That's partially it.
That's true.
So it has to be
a national law.
Absolutely.
And then you run right smack up against that constitutional guarantee.
They didn't have automatics then.
You're correct. I watched Sarah Brady. I've known her, and I know her husband very well. And
would that be true if he allied himself with all the law enforcement people all over the country?
Yeah, and they're perhaps the most positive leverage coming in on this issue, because their life is on the line. Mm-hmm. And we see day after day tragic stories. Here's a savings loan up in Washington where this poor individual, a demented man, went in and killed these innocent people with a handgun.
Mr. Senator?
Yes, sir.
The president's life is on the line.
Yes, sir.
And that is very serious. We ought not to wait, I think, until an AK-47 gets in before we get a national law.
Well, I'm not suggesting it isn't coming. It may come. And I, for one, will look at it very carefully. I assure you, because I personally don't see how they contribute to the hunting fraternity at all. So it may come, despite the president's slight hesitancy here of a few days ago to reach out and seize on an initiative that I think would have given him overwhelming support across this nation.
Mike Tremaine?
Yes.
Somebody who spoke about the importance of the judiciary, what do you think might happen to the increase in salaries for them and you all? Will it come back again soon?
subject is a pay raise for Congress.
The ex-pay raise.
Well, there we perform one of our greater acts of cowardice. There's no doubt about it. I've never witnessed a poorer performance than the Congress here in the last few weeks on that issue. I mean, let's face it. We're so proud of the fact we come back home and we tell you, I voted for this, or I voted against that. But we weren't going to vote for the pay raise. We were going to do it through the back door and actually down through the basement. And we hold hostage innocent people, i.e. men and women who committed their entire adult life to serve on the judiciary. It's life tenure. They have almost no ability to supplement their income. Likewise, senior civil servants. There are many entities in our federal system today which cannot go out and competitively hire individuals to come in. The health and human sciences area and the research and development area are two of the most acute. And therefore, we've got to face up to their plight. And I'm confident that within a short period of time, we will split off, because fortunately the public is just totally intolerant. And we'll split off the judicial salaries. We'll split off the civil servant and make reasonable adjustments upward. Now, what do we do for ourselves? Well, I'll tell you candidly what I think we should do. And I'd be interested in your view. Each individual that comes to the Congress comes from a different background, by and large. Now, it's easy for me to stand up and demagogue this issue because, frankly, I have outside income. I'm not dependent on my Senate salary. And therefore, I can maintain a lifestyle that I desire by virtue of accumulated dollars before I came into the Senate. Now, should I sit there in judgment of another member of the Congress who, for example, lives in New Mexico and has to travel home every other weekend, whose wife has to maintain a house not only in New Mexico, he's required to do it, and a house in Washington, and he has four or five children, two of whom trying to go to the University of Virginia and pay the high tuition. Mr. Ex-President, I see you over there having a sleep. Is that fair? Well, it isn't fair. So I think what we ought to do, it may sound like cockamamie, but bear out this thought, the solution. We ought to set a salary scale, just say for arbitrary, $150,000 to $75,000 or $50,000 to serve in the United States Senate. And let a senator come in and say, look, here's what I have. Here's my family. Here are my children. These are my obligations. Maybe I have a sick elderly parent that I'm caring for. And I'm going to take this salary and just pick it and say I'm going to take the 150 or the 140 or the 130 or 75. And then go back to the people of his constituency and say, all right, you want to elect me? This is what I'm going to take for a salary. I don't know. That may be one idea to do it. But I can tell you right now, we're going to lose good people, possibly ones that are in there now. And we're discouraging many from coming in. And I do not want to see that club in the Senate just become a 100% millionaire outfit. It's already up to around 35 or 40 who have $1 million or more of private wealth. I don't think that's a healthy thing. Way out there. Yes, sir. Let me hear a little better. Yeah.
Why don't you come forward a little bit?
I think I can get it.
Okay. This is a story more than a question.
Good. also the coal industry, if my recollection serves me. Yes, now it's coming back. Thank you, Carl. Appreciate it. I'll be looking for you again in 1990.
Dr. Chris Bell.
Yeah. Senator, have the duties of the drug czar been defined?
No, they have not as yet been fully designed.
Do you have to approve his duty?
No, I think that would be primarily up to the president to lay that out. And he's going to give him, I think, every bit of authority that he needs. And I think the Congress will be totally supportive. This is the most insidious thing that in my lifetime has infiltrated into our society. And we've got to come to grips with it. And we're going to have to use just absolute brute force to deal with this situation.
Why do you object to arrest by the Army if they go through a civil court and not through an Army court?
It's because...
I don't want them to go through an Army court.
No. The reason being that... First place, you ask a young man or a woman to volunteer today to defend the nation.
And so you defend the nation from Coke.
I understand that. But in my judgment, they didn't ask to serve as policemen. We may have a different opinion on that, but I think it would just be ill-advised. We're also beginning to see now in the change of demographics. The first situation where this all-volunteer force may be coming a little rocky because there isn't the man-woman power pool out there in terms of numbers to meet the demands of the private sector and the armed forces altogether. And people are beginning to look once again at national service and perhaps conscription and the like. And if we got into conscription and you required an individual to come in, and I question there more severely whether or not that individual should be committed to a police activity and required to perform arrests. Yes, sir.
Senator, you referred in your opening statement to the role of, to your role in the selection of judges. I seem to recall newspaper reports a couple, 3 years ago indicating that you had delegated much of that to Senator Tribble. Were those reports correct? And if so, could you explain your...
Yes. The way we worked that out, since we had two senators in the same state, both senators of the president's party, the most amicable situation was we'd simply alternate. As the vacancies occurred, we would alternate. And that's why he had entire responsibility when he was dealing with the vacancy, and then the corollary, I had entire responsibility. So rather than delegation, it was simply division, and we took it as the vacancies came up for the judiciary, the U.S. Marshal, and United States Attorney. Now, as the sole senator of the president's party, I will have the entire responsibility. However, subject to the following, which is very interesting, and this is another Senate tradition that goes way back into the sinews of this outfit, and it's simply called senatorial courtesy. And that means that if the other senator is not of the president's party, as it is with my good friend Chuck Robb, whom I've known for a decade or more, when I select an individual, I send to Chuck Robb what is known as a blue slip, and it simply says that Senator John Warner of Virginia is recommending to the President of the United States, and the President is about to concur, in the name of Mr. or Mrs. to be a United States District Court or whatever the case may be. Now, the other senator, for any reason whatsoever, can just take that and put it in his pocket, that blue slip. And the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, doesn't make any difference whether it's Republican or Democrat, will not convene the committee to consider that nomination. And it just is like a pocket veto. That's the end of it. Senatorial courtesy doesn't require the other senator to say, this is the reason. You simply take the blue slip and put it in your pocket. Now, Senator Robb and I, again, fortunately, having known each other and worked with each other, I knew him, I was Secretary of the Navy. He was in the White House as an aide, so we go back a long way. We have already sat down and discussed that in context of the judicial nominations I'll be making next week. And I've, as a courtesy, going to share with him the names of the individuals beforehand to save anyone any embarrassment. And if he, for any reason, has said to me, this individual I find is not in my liking, that's it. Absolute veto. And I would not question his judgment at all. Yes?
One subject we haven't touched on is the budget. How do you feel about line item veto for the president?
All right. The line item veto, as you know, is employed in 40-some states, including
42,
Commonwealth of Virginia. And it functions very well. It gives the governor of that state enormous power. But I have voted for the line item veto every single time it has come up. But I'd be less than candid with you if I told you, in my judgment, it would ever be adopted by the Congress of the United States. Because it would represent to the Congress entirely too much yielding of their authority. And even though it's the doctrine of separation of powers between the two branches of government, we don't want to give that president that much authority. Why? It's painful to tell you this, and it's a four-letter word, P-O-R-K. We carefully splice into pieces of legislation those little projects, little in dollar volume, which we love, be it a road or a bridge or a grant. This fine gentleman, as I walked in, said, Senator, you're interested in the War Powers Act. And I said, I am. I see we need an institution like yours to make an independent, pragmatic, objective analysis of that horrible piece of legislation. He said, if you get me a grant, I can do it right here. I mean, that occurs on a daily basis wherever I move. You know, my pockets are stuffed with requests for grants. And it might be that I just could get that grant, but I'll carefully put it in a piece of legislation surrounded by things that the president desperately wants, such that he cannot veto that bill and take Warner's grant to this esteemed institution out, because he'd lose all the things that he wants. My fair lady, I tell you of the great quote of Winston Churchill, who one time stood up in Parliament and shook his fist at his colleagues and said, the first duty of every elected official, pause, is not to his country, but to get reelected. Yes?
One of the things that concerns me greatly is something you alluded to a little bit ago, which is the power of the lobbies and the PACs, because the implication being that sometimes you must vote against what you know is right and what is good and remaining a politician. Is anything ever going to be done to curb the power?
Yeah, the other curse word in our business is the mother's milk of politics is money. And regrettably, we are so dependent to get elected on that. I opened up by saying I don't have the opportunity to travel the state very often, which is true. In the old days, the Senate met for 5 or 6 months, and then we were back home. Now we meet for practically 12 months with very short periods in which we can go out and travel our state. So while I have an opportunity to visit here today, and this is indeed a very profitable exchange, of the nearly 6 million people in this state, I'm lucky if I see 0.5% in a situation like this. But I've got to go out and get their votes. The only way I can do it, quite frankly, is through television, a very expensive media, or through advertising in the newspaper or radio. So when I come up for election, and I'm beginning very shortly to begin to raise money, $3 or $4 million, in small increments. I emphasize that, relatively small. $1,000 is the maximum that you can give to my 1990 campaign. And if I get the nomination, you can give another 1,000. But if you extrapolate that into 4 million, and most folks don't give the 1,000, it's not as generous as you potentially would be. So that takes a lot of time to travel around. I'll get to the answer, but I want to do a little background. A lot of time to travel around. Now, in sharp contrast, the next governor of Virginia, and there are now 5 individuals, one of whom is likely to be the governor, they can receive and have received, because they've been reported, donations of $100,000. There are several major builders in Northern Virginia who have put $100,000 down, and it's in the newspaper, reported. That's a sizable piece of cash. To me, that moves very close to the situation that you mentioned, that somehow that governor or elected official who raised that type of sum of money can be, you know, persuaded is a gentler word than influenced to the cause that you might wish. But you, my lovely friend, for that $1,000, I'll look you square in the eye, like the old senator said, and I'll vote the way you want me to vote, yay or nay, depending on how I feel, though. Because, you know, out of 4 million, $1,000 is not going to make or break me, and I don't feel obligated to anyone. Ever, having been there 10 years and not being solely dependent on this job for a livelihood, on the contributions. Now, PACs. PACs can give you up to $5,000. They represent the major organizations. They came into being because the labor unions for years had their own financial structure where they pumped just millions of dollars into the political system. And primarily for the Democratic Party, and the Republicans came along and started the PAC concept. Now what's happened? If you look at the statistics, the Democrats are getting more money from the PACs than are the Republicans. And the other side of the coin is that the incumbents are getting more money from the PACs than are the challengers. But again, I don't think anybody in the Senate would ever be persuaded to really do anything of a major consequence as a result of a $4,000 or $5,000 contribution. Because most of us, my race could cost anywhere from $3 to $6 million, depending on who challenges me in 1990. And this state is on the low side of the equation. Jesse Helms in North Carolina was $14 million race. Pete Wilson just finished up in California, $17 billion race. But the real downside is not so much the possibility of leverage on this political money, but it's the time consumed by a legislator in raising that money. I mean, I could turn this into a fundraiser, which I won't do, but I'll have to do similar meetings like this over and over and over again in the next 2 years in the hopes to get the sufficient funds to go out and buy the television to express to the people of Virginia what my record has been, my ability to go on and pursue the goals and philosophies that hopefully we share for another 6 years. And my opponent, I hope, I like a good stiff political race, I enjoy it, will just batter me equally hard, again, using funds from other individuals. Tough system. Yes.
Senator, the major is giving me the eye.
I got three stops today to speak here in Charlottesville, and 2 yesterday. It's been a marvelous trip.
May I just say one thing?
Yeah.
You intimated as we came in that we ought to get going right away, so I kept the introduction short on the theory that one person mentioned in about introductions. If he does well, the introduction isn't necessary. If he does poorly, that'll make me a liar.
Yeah.
So we didn't say much, but there is one thing that I know the chairman of our board would want me to say, and allow me to quote publicly Governor Linwood Holton, who is the chairman of the board and a good friend of Senator Warner, has said not once but dozens of times that if he had known that we would have the distinguished, hardworking, productive senator that we now have,
he would not run, have run against you. I guess that's about the highest tribute anybody has.
I appreciate that. And I hasten to tell you, and Edgar Shannon was there, and we both got out of the Navy in 1946, and he'd been an ensign, and I'd been a petty officer, and we went into the same fraternity, and Governor Holton busted a paddle across my derriere. But he is a good man. And I thank each of you for coming out this morning. It's been a real pleasure. And I carry away with me a little more knowledge than when I cross these doors. And that's so important to me.
So do
and
we.
Useful for my time. Thank you, Carrie.